appreciating that uncertainty, and also appreciating that our decisions are so driven by desire that this creates like a sort of an unreconcilable conflict. And there was a big pop, and I looked up and watched the whole area above us come unglued, and then the two of us that were at the Nunatak started running to the west as fast as we could. And it was one of those situations where you're watching it unfold and looking upslope of you, and I was sort of thinking, maybe I've got this. Hello, everyone. This is David Lovejoy, and you're listening to the Avalanche Hour.
You are tuned in to another episode of the Avalanche Hour podcast, your source for great conversations within the snow and avalanche community. I'm your host, Harry Keene. The Avalanche Hour podcast is proudly presented by Bison Avalanche Control. Safety through innovation. With additional sustaining support from Gordini, we keep you outside longer. And Open Snow. Visit opensnow.com to get started with a free trial and enter the discount code AVALANCHEPODCAST at checkout to receive 30% off your first year of Open Snow All Access. The goal of this podcast is to create a stronger community through the sharing of stories, knowledge, and news amongst people who have a curious fascination with avalanches.
Hey, this is Caleb stepping in here. Harry, thanks so much for reaching out to me and wanting to interview one of your mentors, David Lovejoy. I was hoping you could just tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, what hooked you in the outdoors, and some of your roles within the snow and avalanche industry.
Thanks, Caleb. Yeah, right on. I feel like a broken record saying thanks for the opportunity. But yeah, it felt really cool to interview David and mountain history and document some of that stuff. So the way my outdoor pursuits and profession go was growing up in Mount Shasta. There are a lot of awesome role models out there that like to play around in the mountains and also have a pretty balanced life. So learned, had some solid ski partners in high school, and we would go out and get sunburned and whole bunch of trouble out there on the volcano and build some kickers and just put on our alpine trekkers and have a fun time with it. Yeah, gained mentorship kind of in the first professional realm with Nick at the Forest Service and John Dove. We would go out and ski together, and they'd be working, so they'd be digging pits, and I would look over their shoulders and maybe write some things down, and it was cool. I feel like with curiosity with avalanches, it goes hand in hand with backcountry skiing. I knew the consequences and wanted to stay educated and alive out there. And then after high school, I went to Prescott College. I knew I was in love with the mountains, so I wanted to try and fall in love with the desert. I met David down there doing avalanche classes. We did a class called Avalanche Forecasting and ended up doing an independent study with that he mentored with Jeff Davis at the CAIC and also with Nick at the Shasta Avalanche Center, comparing continental and maritime snowpacks. And graduated from Prescott, and that was close to summer. Did a volunteer program called the Climbing Stewards with Yosemite National Park, and love to climb, love to get into the vertical realm, tap into that vertical mindset. It's a unique place. I feel like skiing, it's a little bit different. Did that program, the Yosemite Climbing Steward program, and met Eric Lynch, and he used to be a climbing ranger up in Leavenworth, Washington, and got a job in Leavenworth, Washington as a climbing ranger. And in the winter for Prescott College, I actually teach level 2 avalanche forecasting class. I've been doing that for the past 4 years up in Victor. So that's a month long thing. Pretty hardcore recreationalist right now, I would say, and a little bit of a pro.
What drew you to want to interview David?
David is such a character. He looks like Obi-Wan Kenobi, and he's just this kind of prolific statue, I would say. Why I wanted to interview David was he has contributed a lot to the Avalanche community. I feel like he's kind of, there's like LaChapelle, Jerry Roberts, you know, kind of these people who have created Avalanche studies. And David has learned from those people. Like, he is kind of that link between them. And history, I think, is cool. And it felt like a way to appreciate that trickle down of knowledge. And David has mentored a lot of other folks from that flow. So it felt like kind of, I don't know, fourth wave of knowledge or of documented history that I was recording.
Well, without further ado, let's jump into Harry's interview with David Lovejoy.
David, thanks for making time to talk. I feel honored to conduct this interview with you. To start things off, I was hoping that you could maybe introduce yourself, talk a little bit about your background, where you're from, and some of your early memories in the mountains.
Okay. Well, I grew up in a small town in central Ohio called Westerville. My parents were academics. Father was a sociologist, my mother a librarian. I was one of three brothers, the middle one, all close in age, all born between 1950 and 1952. And we were kind of a family camping family, car camping family. And on during the summers, we'd go off and tour mainly the West and stay at national parks and so forth. So really, one of my first memories of being interested in the mountains was at Rocky Mountain National Park, where I think we'd hiked into Chasm Lake below the east face of Long's Peak, and I saw some big burly guys getting ready to climb something, and they had ice axes and crampons. I was just, as a young boy, intrigued and inspired. A couple years later, we ended up in Grand Teton National Park, and my parents sent my older brother and I to Exum School of Mountaineering for mountain climbing lessons. And that was an amazingly enriching experience. And we did some guided climbing after that. In fact, at the age of 14, guided, of course, I climbed the Owen Spaulding route on the Grand. And so that pretty much gave me enough information to get in trouble. And back in Ohio, I kind of started training friends and rappelling off of rooftops and out of trees. And one summer, my father bought us a nylon rope from Sears and Roebuck's, and my brother and I actually climbed the central chimney route on Katahdin Peak in Baxter State Park. And that was hair-raising in its own right. I nearly dropped a big boulder on my brother, and that was pretty much the last time he ever wanted to join me climbing. But luckily, I got kind of saved by some folks who were part of a pretty active outing club in Columbus, Ohio, through the American Youth Hostel Association. And a guy named Peter Fromm and John Markwell, who later became the owner of the Seneca Rocks Guide Service and the store there called the Gendarme, took me under their wing, and they kind of gave me a little bit more formal training, recognizing that without it, I was probably just going to kill myself. So that I sort of carried on and developed basically as a rock climber, climbing at a place called Clifton Gorge in Ohio near Yellow Springs and at Seneca Rock in my high school years. And then, you know, later, starting with summer trips with my parents, to Glacier in the Canadian Rockies, did some climbing with a friend who came along. Then in the summer before I went to college, did a pretty major trip out to the Wind River Range and climbed a lot there and at Rocky Mountain National Park and on Long's Peak. And that's kind of my start.
How did you end up at Prescott College? And how did you end up teaching there after you graduated?
Well, yeah, this was back in the Vietnam War era. And interestingly, my particular birth year was the last year where they were giving student deferments. And to avoid draft, I knew I needed to go to college. So I was intrigued by Prescott College's innovative educational program, but perhaps equal to that was understanding a little bit about the sort of fledgling outdoor program called the Outdoor Action Program that was taking place there under the directorship of a guy named Roy Smith. And so, I came as a geology student, but equally important was just to be able to take advantage of what I perceived to be good rock climbing locally. And that was certainly an formative part of my life. And I became, a really avid rock climber in Arizona. And at the time, I was kind of right place, right time, kind of was able to sort of do a lot of pioneering routes, not because I had any particular skill. It was just sort of a time and place coincidence. And, my senior project ended up being one where I wrote the first guidebook to Granite Mountain, kind of one of the more noteworthy of the local areas. Even while I was a student, I was teaching rock climbing. I became friends with Rusty Bailey, who was working for the program. We became climbing partners, and he gave me a lot of work opportunities to teach rock climbing while I was a student. And after graduation, I was invited to come back and teach as an adjunct faculty member. The school went through a rough time financially and a bankruptcy, and started in a new fledgling version of the college under Mike Goff, who was another mentor of mine. And originally it was just Mike who was running the Outdoor Action, later to become the Adventure Education Program. But I was invited to apply for a faculty position, which I did, and I prevailed. And that started the beginning of 37-year career with Prescott College.
Tell me about the painted wall in the Black Canyon of the Gunnison.
Oh, well, that was a project. That was kind of Rusty Bailey's inspiration. It was a big unclimbed wall in the Black Canyon of the Gunnison. It was speculated that it might become the first grade 6 in Colorado. And Rusty had attempted it at least once, maybe more times with Leighton Kaur. And then he teamed up with a couple of really qualified rock climbers from Flagstaff, Arizona, Scott Baxter and Carl Carlstrom, and they made an attempt in 1971. I kind of helped to support them, helped them carry gear to the bottom, and then watched during their attempt. They were unsuccessful, but the following year they asked me to join them, and we went back and we were successful at climbing that wall. Big project for us back then. We spent 9.5 days on the wall. Big wall, primarily aid route, has been since been pretty much climbed free, I think, by Jeff Ackey. Not exactly the same route that we took, but pretty close. And that just shows how times have changed. But that was certainly the most challenging and rigorous exploit of my time, maybe one that's stands in that position even now. But that was that was 50 years ago.
Any memorable pitches on the painted wall?
I remember a hard aid pitch that had stopped a lot of the previous attempts on the wall. And I was able to push through on it. I remember I ripped out a rope or something, and I bounced down the wall, pulling out pins as I went, and stopped. And there was enough friction in the line that they my belayer didn't even realize that I had fallen. So, but I was able to go back up and get through that. But it was a hard aid pitch. I think, you know, one of the reasons that I, you know, wasn't like I was a, such a brilliant climber, I think one of the attributes that was considered most advantageous was my weight. I was a little guy, so I was light. And so they figured, you know, it makes a big difference when you're doing hard aid routes.
When did you first get interested in snow and avalanche studies? And who were your mentors in both the mountaineering and snow science realm?
Well, I was sort of a late bloomer in terms of skiing. I really didn't, you know, I went skiing a couple of times in high school, but really I didn't start skiing until I was in college, ironically in Arizona on San Francisco peaks, and then elsewhere where courses took me, I suppose. But snow studies, as is true with many folks, was kind of an outgrowth of my interest in backcountry skiing. I was, you know, I guess I, my feeling at the time was that, lifts were kind of a place for, rich twits. And, you know, I was far above that. So backcountry, like coming up with a method that we could use in the backcountry was, really what was inspirational to me. And then I soon realized that, I needed to learn about avalanches, or that was going to be a fairly short-lived, passion. In the mountains, I suppose my mentors were Rusty Bailey and Mike Goff were my greatest mentors. But in the snow studies realm, the first snow or avalanche course I took was at Silverton Avalanche School. And my instructors were Richard and Betsy Armstrong and Chris George and George Pastor, some people that were, you know, kind of the first wave of experts in avalanche studies in the country. Later on, I went on to the National Avalanche School, where Ed LaChapelle was an instructor. Peter Lev was my group leader. The field courses that I did in Crested Butte, Colorado, were led by Rod Newcomb, Don Bachman, and Art Mears. So I feel very, very fortunate that these names that are, you know, considered to be kind of the founders of avalanche sciences in the United States were people that I actually had direct contact with. And so that kind of put me on my path. It just became a, you know, a passion, as it has for so many people. And, you know, I guess I, you know, in a way, I became sort of self-trained through my own reading and attendance at pretty much all the ISSWs from back then until present, and you know, and some other work too. I've done some work at Montana State University and got to know John Montaigne and people like that too. So I just feel very fortunate in terms of the people who I've had contact with.
Yeah, Chappelle is somebody that I've come across some papers that he's wrote, and it does seem like he's one of the founding folks in the avalanche studies.
Without a doubt, yeah.
As someone who's been a player in the game of avalanche studies and snow science for decades, what kind of evolution have you witnessed within the realm of snow science, public forecasting, and avalanche education?
That's a good question. It's changed a lot. Yeah. Boy, I'd say, well, for one, it's grown a lot. The people who are interested and involved in this discipline has expanded amazingly. It's become much more formal, I would say, and sophisticated. It's integrated a lot of the sort of methods of modern science in terms of sensing and so forth, modeling. And in some respects, I think it's also changed so that there's a recognition that despite all those innovations, there's still a lot of uncertainty, and that you can't just teach people a lot of science and expect them to be able to be safe in the mountains. You know, in the early days, it seemed like the people who were getting into trouble were those that were uninformed. Now the people that are getting in trouble are some of the most informed. So it illustrates that that uncertainty is still a big issue in decision making and the whole thing, the whole realm that's pretty much called the human factor in decision making has really come to a head. But in terms of size, I think the first ISSW that I went to, which I think was in 1995 at Snowbird, was around 200 participants. And the most recent one up in Bend, Oregon, I think was over 2,000 participants. So it just shows the growth of the industry, so to speak. There's also been, I think, more an effort towards more consistency in language and messaging. You see that in the forecast centers through the way avalanches are described and problems and so forth. And that has done a lot of things to sort of clarify and give people more tools to use in avoidance. But as I said, you know, despite all of that, I think, you know, I'm guessing the number of fatalities is reduced markedly, but it's not like they've been eliminated.
Yeah, it's well known that the more years of exposure in the mountains, the probability of having close calls becomes more likely. Do you have any wisdom to impart on the young professionals in regards to managing risk?
Yeah, I guess just appreciating that uncertainty and also appreciating that our decisions are so driven by desire that this creates like a sort of an unreconcilable conflict. What I try to do, I think, is in my own practices, is I try to envision the places where I'm likely to run into problems and then pre-plan a bunch of locations to sort of reassess, not only internally, but in terms of communication with all my partners out there, and kind of make everyone state their opinion on how they think things are going or their concerns and so forth. And also, in my experience, a lot of incidents have a lot of little errors that compound. It's not like it's just a black and white thing. I think that you need to sort of, as you progress through a tour, sort of look at the things that are happening and that are changing the overall circumstance and recognize that they may be building on each other and could lead to an unfortunate outcome. I've been really fortunate in that I haven't actually been directly involved in any catastrophic accidents with my own friends and partners. And I feel unbelievably fortunate for being able to have avoided that. But I have had a few near misses that have just really opened up my eyes. And I think it's interesting that some of the most experienced people I've ever been out with are some of the most conservative. And, you know, you go out with somebody with a lot of experience and you think, oh, this will be good because this person's going to show me when I can ski and when I can't. And that's not really what I've felt by watching the way they operate. I've found them feeling the same kind of uncertainty that I have.
Did you find that the older you got, the more conservative you got by choosing terrain?
Well, yes, I suppose that's true. And for a whole variety of different reasons. You know, I think a young person's attitudes, or at least particularly young men's attitudes, are different than once you age and you know, recognize how you go from feeling invincible to just feeling unbelievably vulnerable. And you recognize how precious life is. And so that really changes the way you do things. Yes, some of the near misses that I've experienced were when I was young. A lot of them were just inexperience, just that. I just made errors that now I'm much more conscious of trying to avoid.
Do you have a specific avalanche that stands out in your memory?
Well, there's a number, but probably the king of them all was a big Actually, it was a natural avalanche that occurred on Mount Shasta when I was there with a group of Prescott College students that pretty much could have been really bad. There'd been a bunch of low elevation rain, high elevation snow in the period leading up to a summit attempt on the top of the mountain, and then it was followed by some unusually warm weather and some loose snow avalanches that point releases that started up in the Red Banks area. This was on the Avalanche Gulch route, slid down and triggered a very large slab avalanche that went from kind of cold snow up just below the Red Banks and then ended up entraining a lot of wet snow down below. But it was one of those events where we were crossing underneath the path to a place where we had deemed to be a safe zone. Didn't turn out to be a safe zone, but we were traveling one at a time. And two of us had reached this little sort of Nunatak feature where we had our skis stashed. And there were four in our party, and the third person was crossing the area of vulnerability. And there was a big pop, and I looked up and watched the whole area above us come unglued. And then the two of us that were at the Nunatak started running to the west as fast as we could. And it was one of those situations where you're watching it unfold and looking up slope of you. And I was sort of thinking, maybe I've got this. The student was a faster runner and was out ahead of me. And then a sympathetic slide occurred, and the two flows converged, and that turned the path of the avalanche slide in my direction. And I went, no, I'm done. You know, I'm done. This is basically how it's all going to end. And I kept running, and I kind of dove out in front of the debris. It came by. It was that close. And then immediately stood up, and a young lady who was one of my students, who was the one who was crossing, had also been running in the same direction that we were, but she was behind and she was caught by the slide. And so I kind of ran down slope, trying to keep an eye on her the whole time. Fortunately, she was kind of spit out at the edge and only about half buried. There was a fourth student was on the far side of the path that hadn't started and was in a safe zone. But that avalanche was giant, probably had at least a 6-foot crown line on it, and crown thickness. And it ran for thousands of feet, way past kind of the horse camp area. And days later, when we looked back at Shasta, we could see that slide from probably 50 miles away. So it was a very, very poignant near miss. And there are a whole variety of reasons. I've read a report and analyzed it a lot, and lots of little reasons that all compounded to make this a problem for us. But we were very lucky in that no one was injured or killed. And all of our skis, though, that were in what we thought was our safe zone, were buried and unretrievable till later the year when the ranger gradually dug them all out.
Where were you on the mountain when that happened?
We had ascended up to sort of the point where you would depart from the main avalanche gulch and go up towards the east, where you're sort of skirting to the east of all the Red Banks. So we were at the point where you sort of change aspects and go up to a point on the ridge above, then you're sort of entering the summit plateau. So we were at the base of that area. So I can't tell you the number of well above Lake Helen. But interestingly enough, as we watched the avalanche flow down past us, there was two people down below that were right in the path that abandoned their packs and ran for their lives to the east, and that turned out to be one of the climbing rangers and a friend, and they lost their packs, got buried in the event.
Hmm. Seems like a pretty warm day.
It was warm. It was warm. And it's one of those things that's a little bit hard to assess, because as you climb a big mountain like that, it cools as you go. And so up on the plateau, it still seemed colder. It was windier up there, you know, at the summit and coming down. As soon as we came around to that southern face, then it's like, whoa, it is hot down here. And we started seeing the snowpack responding accordingly.
And you were descending at that time?
Yes, we were descending. Yeah. But it wasn't late in the day. It was, I think, around, well, later than it should have been, but about 12:30, just after noon.
As someone who's traveled widely in the mountain environments, what perspectives do expeditions play in your background?
Oh boy, I love expeditions. I mean, it's just such a great thing to do, where you have an objective and you have a bunch of friends, presumably, and you're off to a faraway land to do something. I guess, you know, I think of the whole package as being the important part of it. And if I look back at expeditions I've done, probably successes at attaining our primary objective have been less than 50%. I think it's important that you recognize that there are all sorts of good things about that effort that, you know, perhaps even surpass meeting your objective. And I think of just spending the time with great friends in the mountains. And also a big part of it is just learning about the geography of a different area, both the physical and the human geography. So I really value the expedition experiences I've had, but I would say that the attainment of primary objective is just a small part of it for me.
I was wondering if you could tell the story about Alaskan bush plane flying, landing on a lake that was too small, and the the mechanism you had to use to get the plane in the air.
Well, this was actually one of my earliest expeditions, and I did a slideshow on it, which I titled Blunder in the Tundra. and we were going in to climb, I think it's the west face of Igikpak Peak in the Brooks Range. It was Rusty Bailey and Carl Carlstrom and myself. And we had been poring over maps with our bush pilot in Bettles, Alaska. His name was Paul Shanahan. And we found a little lake, and we looked at it with him, and he said, yeah, I've seen that lake. I think we can get in there. So we jumped in his little short takeoff and landing Cessna and went in there, pontoon plane. And we get to the lake, and it turns out that it's two lakes, and there's a beaver dam right in the middle of it. So it's small to begin with, and then now it's split in half. And so we circled it, and we circled it, and he's didn't look very comfortable. And we circled and circled, and we were like, what's wrong, Paul? And he's like, well, it's that beaver dam. That doesn't give me a whole lot of space there, you know. And he said, and there's not a breath of air. And I thought, oh, that's good. And he said, well, no, that's not good. I want some wind to land against. And he said, there's some geese down there, you know. I don't know if they'll dive or fly. I need something to give me some depth perception, because I got to hit that water like right after that beaver dam. So anyway, he swallowed and we went in, and it was terrifying. You know, watching that bank approach at a zillion miles an hour, sure that it was just going to be the end of us, but he got it stopped right there. But he was really concerned about his takeoff, and so we used climbing ropes to tether the tail of the plane, and he revved up his engines. The plane was just hopping there where we had a blade around some little black birches or something, and then he gave us a sign, and we released the ropes, and he went across the lake, and they pull one pontoon out to reduce friction, but the other pontoon hit the beaver dam, and he dove down, and we thought he was done, but he picked it up and he got the plane out of there. Of course, our plan had been no communications back then. This was in 1972. And, he did an airdrop for us, which had its own set of issues. But we found a small note in the airdrop that said, I call that lake never again. And then it said, I suggest you walk to Walker Lake where I'll pick you up. And we had an agreement to be picked up 6 weeks after we were dropped off. It was pretty hair-raising. I'd say that some of the scariest experiences I've had on big mountains have involved airplanes rather than the climbing.
What was the food drop like? Was that successful?
Everything went wrong on this particular expedition, and we could probably spend the rest of the time talking about it. But one of the things that did happen, it was, they're just throwing some boxes and bags out of an airplane at low elevation to get us all our food. And so we were about 10 miles from a meadow below the face that we were going to attempt to climb. And we had a haul bag that he threw out of the plane, and it was a very clean meadow, but it had one rock in it. This haul bag hit the only rock in the meadow and just pretty much pulverized about 50% of our food. So one of the elements of this trip that was challenging was that we ran out of food quite a while before our pickup time. And so we left and hiked towards Walker Lake early. That was quite a bit further away than the little lake Never Again. And we really were low on food, and it was kind of an epic.
Did you get a rope up during that expedition at all, or was it pretty dire?
Oh, no, we did. We did. There were, we could tell stories all day long about it. I came close to losing my life on that one, too. Yeah, we had a big rock and ice avalanche that came down and inundated the area. I learned a lot about, the reason I called the slideshow Blunder in the Tundra is it showed how little we knew about mountain environments and how little we took that into consideration when determining the tactics we were going to use. And, up there in the Arctic, when you have 24-hour sun, you really don't get that diurnal cooling that's needed to lock ice, snow and ice together and keep the rock that's glued together by the ice from falling down the face. So we had an amazing amount of natural rock fall and rock and ice avalanches. We were lucky to survive.
Wow. Sounds hair-raising. As a long-term faculty member at Prescott College, who has influenced many aspiring snow professionals, what's your perspective on mentorship?
The word mentorship always sounds a little bit like more than I've contributed, like it gives more credibility to my level of influence. I feel like more than mentorship, I've just sort of created an enthusiasm for mountain studies and for snow and ice studies and for avalanche studies, snow science, and also tried to enable people to see the opportunities that exist. So a lot of people, there's a huge number of people who've graduated from Prescott College that I'm very proud of and gone on to do amazing things in the world of snow and avalanches, science and so forth, mountain studies. And I feel like the amount of influence I had over that has been almost indirect. It has really had to do more of the enthusiasm that I think I had for it. Maybe I just made it, cool to be a geek. Sometimes I feel like I'm sort of a regular guy, and that made other folks feel like they had potential too, if he can do it, I can do it, sort of thing. And so much like other people have influenced me, it hasn't always been in sort of a role where I've been an apprentice to somebody, but it's been more about contacting somebody who's opened up opportunities for me. And so I feel like that's really the role that I've played more than anything. Lots of people that never even took a class from me who have gone on to become notable avalanche professionals
Who are some of those notable Avalanche professionals?
Oh boy, Harry, I'm reluctant to drop names because then I'll feel like I'm excluding people, and the list is probably maybe up to 100 people. I mean, some of the stars in my mind are people like Angela Haas, who's become noted in the leadership of American Mountain Guides Association and in the American Alpine Club, Doug Chabot, who is the director of the Gallatin National Forest Avalanche Center. And, the list goes on. There's a number of people who have, developed winter guide services. I'm thinking of people like Diane Verna, Amos Whiting, Joe St. Ange. People have gone on into helicopter ski operations, Mark Rickers. I mean, we were talking about mentorship. One of the things that I feel really fortunate about, and I've always said this, and I think many educators will say the same, is that the people who claim to have been mentored by me also feel like they have mentored me. And many folks who I've worked with have gone on and gained experience in education and come back to work for Prescott College or come back to do things recreationally with me. And I've learned a lot. I've learned probably the most from them. And that includes people like you. So you're an example of that as well.
Thanks, David. Yeah. We recently spoke with Elif Johnson Bloom, and she mentioned...
Oh, she's one. She's definitely one that would be in that top group. Yes, Elif has become well. She's done well in so many different areas, and she's one of those representatives of the Avalanche Divas too. So yeah, very proud of her.
Yeah, she just mentioned about curiosity and how that plays a role in many of her studies and places she's gone. And I feel like you do a good job of sparking that curiosity with your students.
How can you not be curious about snow? You know, it's just the most intriguing thing ever. You know, every time I'm out, I see something that I scratch my head over and go, that doesn't really quite fit into the matrix of things I understand. And it just immediately makes me want to read more about it or think about ways that I could, dig a little deeper into it. I mean, there's probably five things. I haven't been in the snow that much this winter for, the primary reason being my age and blindness, but I still see things that just are so fascinating in this wild medium.
Yeah. With so much uncertainty in the snowpack, there's often a lot of curiosity that blooms from that.
Yeah, yep.
Besides avalanche education, ski patrol work, and forecasting, what other peripheral interests do you have in the snowscape?
Well, as I just sort of alluded to, I can't stop being interested in it. And I've been involved in a number of formal and informal kind of research projects, a lot of them having to do with the conditions here in the Southwest, where we have an unusual set of circumstances. We have low latitude, high elevation, continental mountains. And so it's dry, it's high, and it's, has a lot of sun, more sort of blue sky days in January than pretty much anywhere that has, a seasonal snowpack. So a lot of those things have piqued my curiosity in terms of how that contributes to weak layer development and hydrology. One of the areas I've been interested in has to do with the evaposublimation of the snowpack, like how much of the water that's contained in the snow do we lose to back to the atmosphere. And originally that was kind of thought of in terms of water resources, but now I think of it also in terms of how it affects snow stability. So lots of peripheral projects and interests that I'm actually still involved in, sometimes as more of an armchair science person, but still involved.
I know you've authored some ISSW papers. I'm curious if you could go into more depth about those.
Okay. Well, yeah, they've been, you know, again, in some of these same areas. I'm interested in the effects of latitude on snow climates and how that manifests itself in contributing to the various different avalanche problems and weak layer development and so forth. And also some of the other attributes that you have in at low latitudes, drier air, radical diurnal temperature shifts, huge amount of insulation, incoming solar radiation input. And so a lot of them have been related to those themes. And there have been some comparisons between what we have on San Francisco peaks here in Arizona, that Kachina Peaks Avalanche Center is concerned with, and comparing those with other sort of nearest neighbors. I did a study where I compared the snowpack here to the La Salles in Utah and to the Red Mountain Pass area in Colorado. A lot of them have been pretty low-tech, sort of simple data analysis studies. I'm working on a project where we're looking at the last 40 years of weather data from up on San Francisco peaks and trying to figure out what the implications are in terms of change.
What type of snow climate would you characterize the San Francisco peaks?
Well, I call it a radiation snowpack. I wrote a little article for TAR on this, but it's a little bit anomalous, and it's not my term. This is something that's been talked about with Armstrong and La Chapelle and some of their early work in the San Juans. And it really has to do with the fact that, down here in the Southwest, we sort of get missed by a lot of the storms. So dramatically more blue sky days than anywhere else. But I would, it's probably intermountain radiation snow climate. But as I indicated in this paper, seasonally, really the kind of storms that we get determine a lot of what the snow climate is. And we get storms approaching by several different storm tracks, and some of those storms end up giving us a much more of a continental kind of flavor, whereas others will even give us more of a maritime sort of flavor. So it's quite variable in that regard.
How did the Kachina Peaks Avalanche Center get started, and what's your role?
Oh, that's a fun one. Well, in a way, Kachina Peaks Avalanche Center, which started in 2005, and I was one of three founders with B.J. Boyle and Angie Kokonakis, who were both involved with the Snowbowl Ski Patrol, as was I at the time. It's really kind of an outgrowth of an earlier project that Dr. Lee Dexter and Art Punn, some other people from Flagstaff, started back in the mid-80s called the San Francisco Mountains Avalanche Project. And some lean years and the fact that the people who were involved got committed to other occupational objectives, that project kind of fizzled. But the winter of 2004-2005 was a really big year down here, and there were some really big natural and human-triggered avalanches, some near misses. And it was actually the first year that I started working as a snow safety specialist for the Arizona Snowbowl Ski Patrol. And BJ was the ski patrol director and Angela the assistant director. So the three of us really started Kachina Peaks Avalanche Center. And we're here in the southwest region of the Forest Service. Most avalanche centers, as I'm sure everyone's aware, have some kind of an affiliation with, a government agency, usually the Forest Service or a national park or some combination of. But there are no avalanche centers in Region 3 of the Forest Service. And so we really started as a nonprofit to try to meet what we perceived to be a need. And the real need was just bringing people up to the current times in terms of sophistication and avalanche education. And so in the early days of Kachina Peaks Avalanche Center, we were primarily an information exchange and education organization. And now we've become a forecast center. We're currently putting out 4 avalanche forecasts a week and self-funded, but I think we're very, very proud of the job that we've done. And we have a very, very engaged group of folks who are involved. And it's actually just a great project, a great success. And we operate on probably between a third and a quarter of the budget that most similar avalanche centers operate at. So we're able to deliver a pretty good product at a low price. And I think that's also worthy of note.
How many forecasters do you all have?
Right now we have 4 forecasters, but only one of, but we basically use the sort of subcontractor model to pay our forecasters. And so we don't have any salaried folks. We have one person who's on at around 30 hours a week. And then the other people, it's kind of piecework.
What's it like to live such an adventurous life and then have to reconcile with your aging? I specifically asked this from a friend who, this is a friend's question, and the question was, why don't you do the Verde River? And this is kind of...
Well, I'm blind, and it's too dangerous for a blind guy to do. Yeah, well, aging is a process of acceptance, you know. It's an interesting thing to have happen. I feel like I wouldn't change a thing about my life. I've led an amazing life. You know, it's interesting, you know, you get physically less capable, but you still have like the perspective of a younger person who still wants to do things, maybe not the same things that you did when you were very young, but I'm still driven to adventure, I suppose, at a modest level, mind you. But the thing that's been the greatest impact on me has been my loss of vision. I have macular degeneration, and so I've had to give up driving even. And that limits my mobility, which, you know, as you can imagine, is a big issue. But I still try to do things. I still ski. Some people think it's not that great an idea. And run rivers and things like that. Don't really rock climb anymore. Can't really see my feet to match them well on the holds, so that's an issue. But it's an interesting thing. It's definitely a double-edged sword because, you know, you get all kinds of accolades for the things you still do by people that go, "Can you believe it? That old blind guy's still doing this." But all you need to do is mess up once, and then it'll just turn right around and bite you in the butt. And people will be going, "Didn't that guy realize he was old and blind? What was he thinking?" So, it is definitely a double-edged sword. You know, I feel like I'm trying to age as gracefully as I can. It's not all. I don't always do a perfect job, and I'm also trying to accept that. Perhaps I am overdoing it sometimes and need to pull the reins back some. That's hard to do, as you might imagine.
Do you think being in the snow for most of your years has contributed to your blindness?
There's been some speculation there. There was about a 5-year period where I was working on an evapo-sublimation study where I had to read some instruments that were hard to read with sunglasses on. So I was sort of sitting in the snow reading instruments, and UV radiation definitely causes the problem to increase more rapidly, but it's primarily a hereditary thing. Both my father and my mother, my mother's still alive, but they had it. And my brother has it almost, one of my brothers is almost as blind as I am, and the other one seems to have escaped it somehow. So it's possible, but, you know, I guess as the expression goes, if you'd known you were going to live this long, you'd taken better care of yourself.
Yeah. Any parting words before we close this interview?
Well, I guess I just feel infinitely grateful to you and Caleb and the folks at the Avalanche Hour for this opportunity. I feel like as I stated before, I just think that one of the great things about the world of snow science is that I think there are opportunities for people at all kinds of different levels. Unlike some academic disciplines where, pedigree is unbelievably important. If you don't have a PhD, nobody's going to listen to you. I feel like this is a field that everybody's united by the fact that they all love to slide on snow, for one. That opens up a lot of opportunities. I guess the ISSW motto of merging theory with practice sort of states it, you know, where we recognize that experience and hands-on work in the snow has a value that's important, not just the theoretical and that of sort of high-tech modern science. And so, I just feel like it's a field that I recommend to anyone that has a passion for it without reservation.
Well, thanks, David. It's been an honor to be in your as a mentee, and getting out in the snow and mountains with you has always been a pleasure of mine, and I'm sure for many other folks too. So thanks for all the work you've done for the snow science community and in the avalanche world.
Well, thank you. The honor's mine, Harry. Thanks so much for all of this.
Yeah, of course. It's been my pleasure. I'm glad we're able to sit down and do this interview together.
All right. We hope that you enjoyed that great interview. Thank you, Harry and David, for putting that together for us. We appreciate it. Harry, I was hoping you could tell the listeners a little bit about the process of recording this interview with one of your mentors. As I feel that this is the way the podcast is kind of trending, I would like to create more opportunity for voices from the community to be able to interview their mentors or their ski partners or their working professional cohorts. So talk a little bit about the process. How streamlined was it? Did you find it to be easy to do? Tell us your experience.
Interviewing David was simple. It was a really unique experience to document that history. It was very easy. Caleb provided time frame when you would get the microphone, which was really helpful. The microphones are really easy to set up, especially with Caleb's help in the Riverside FM studio, kind of producing the whole podcast. Once we were done, we packaged them up, had pre-packaged shipping labels, and shipped them out. It was a breeze.
Yeah, so I've done some work to try and make this process pretty simple and stress-free. And if you have somebody that you would like to interview on the Avalanche Hour podcast, please reach out. You can email us at theavalanchehourpodcast@gmail.com and reach out, and we'll try and set something up for you. Harry, thanks so much for coming on the show today, for being part of this process, and for documenting some of this great history from David Lovejoy. Appreciate it, man.
Thanks, Caleb.
Music on today's episode was written, performed, recorded, and produced by Ketsa. You heard the tracks Going Still and Heaven Dub. You can find more of Ketsa's tracks to inspire creative projects at ketsa.uk. Our artwork was created by Mike T. Thanks, Mike. Check out more of Mike's work on his website, miket.com. This episode was produced by me, Caleb Merrill. Give us a follow on the social media. We are at the Avalanche Hour Podcast on Facebook and Instagram. That's a great way to stay up to date on the latest release of episodes. If you're enjoying the podcast, head on over to Apple Podcasts or Spotify, where you can give us up to a 5-star rating and leave us a short review. It really does help. We love seeing that. If you want to take it a step further, go ahead and tell a friend about the show. Share it around. Spread the love. If you got feedback for us, you can send us an email at theavalanchehourpodcast@gmail.com or find a contact link through our website, theavalanchehour.com. Until next time, stay tuned, stay safe, keep having fun out there. See ya.